Now Jeff Blair can tell you bedtime stories. Subscribe to podcasts of The Jeff Blair Show at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher and listen anytime you want. Sweet dreams. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. A cheeseburger is awesome, but it's even better with bacon. This is The Jeff Blair Show, topped with a sizzling slice of Stephen Brunt. Fill your face. On Toronto Sports Radio, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, welcome back to the Jeff Blair Show with Stephen Brunt. The Team USA sent to the sidelines of the World Cup of Hockey with a 4-2 loss for to Team Canada last night. And safe to say that no team in this tournament has been as big a flop as the Americans.
Well, your Finns are pretty floppish, I would say.
Well, no, the Finns are, you know. The Finns showed pluck.
A bit.
The Finns just weren't good enough. But in, you know what? If this tournament was, if it was six games, the Finns would be there at the end. The Finns would be there at the end.
Yeah, they're playing for the, they're it's all about durability with the Finns.
Right? It is. Yeah. It is.
Playing the long, game.
I may have gone out on a limb and calling the Finns to win the tournament, but.
That, would appear that way right now, that you may have gone out on a limb.
That comes from my, you know, respect for them as an international hockey nation. The fact that their players are the only players, at least I thought, who would take this thing as seriously as the Canadians did. Anyhow, forget about Finland. Forget about Finland. I'd rather talk about the USA because, man, oh, man, there was a lot. They gave us a lot to talk about in a short period of time. Greg Wyshynski is editor of the Puck Daddy blog on Yahoo Sports. He's also co-host of our Merrick versus Wyshynski podcast. And he absolutely ripped Team USA a new one. On Yahoo Sports. So basically you're saying that they should just overhaul the entire thing, correct?
Yeah, and I think the 3 minutes that you've spent being interested in Team USA are more than they spent being interested in that Canada game after going down 3-1 last night, first of all.
They did quit. There was a remarkable willingness to quit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were, I hope ESPN was happy with the ratings for what amounted to the United States taking lackadaisical shots on goal and the Canadians poking a carcass with a stick for like 40 minutes. But no, listen, here's the thing. The future's bright. I mean, you can look at Team North America, to whom I've pledged my allegiance now, and see Austin Matthews and see Jack Eichel and see Brandon Saad and see Shane Gostisbehere and see Haljebuck and Gibson. And you know people are on the way. It helps on the way. Especially offensively. But the real issue is, are we going to go in that direction? Are we going to lean into the curve? Are we going to be a team of skill and speed? Or are we going to stay on the course that we've been on for the last 6 years, which is to build a quote-unquote gritty, sandpaper, jammy team where we leave skill players at home and take role players in a fruitless attempt to build a team to beat Canada? Because this isn't working, and this is the greatest example of it not working. And now we've gotten to the point where the team's even got multiple personality disorder, mm-hmm. where they scratch Dubinsky, who's only there to play Crosby, to put a guy in Palmieri because he's got 30 goals. And meanwhile, they're leaving guys like Phil Kessel and Tyler Johnson home for guys like Dubinsky. So now we're in almost total schizophrenia, too, as a program.
But surely this result will bury that approach, won't it? Like this result plus the way the young American guys have played on Team North America and seeing the success of that team and their success in this tournament, it's pretty much black and white here, isn't it? I can't imagine you can go back and be all Brian Berkey about whatever the next tournament's going to be.
I don't know, because here's the thing about that. If this happened in Canada, if after winning silver in Vancouver, the following two tournaments were as disastrous as they were for the United States. I mean, and this is Canada we're talking about now. There'd be commissions. Mm-hmm. There'd be probably parliamentary hearings.
Yes,
there'd
there
be
would.
Real pressure to completely overhaul the brain trust of this team. I don't know if the same pressures exist inside of USA Hockey, because the guys that put this team together are the guys that also run USA Hockey. Furthermore, I'm not sure if there's the depth of the bench that you'd have in Canada of executives you could turn the keys over to. I mean, I was looking at it last night as far as like NHL general managers that were USA born. The only guy I come up with that could walk in and maybe change the conversation is Ray Shiro, and he's had some, you know, experience at the international level as well. So I hope so, but you're essentially asking, you know, Dean Lombardi, Brian Burke, and the rest of them to change their stripes, because I don't think there's going to be a sweeping overhaul of personnel at the top of this program anytime soon.
How is this loss going to be viewed in the U.S.?
Well, that kind of speaks to how the World Cup of Hockey will be viewed in the U.S. And, I mean, I've been obviously up here covering it, so I don't have a perfect scope of what this tournament looks like back home, but I kind of have an idea. And it's not necessarily on the radar anywhere near where the Olympics would be.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this loss is going to get a lot of attention in the next 24 to 48 hours, and then it'll be forgotten about until news comes down as far as, you know, the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
And if we go, who's going to coach the team? I think from an impact standpoint, it's an embarrassment, primarily because it's Canada, and also because all these players were so excited to get back on ESPN in the States. Literally, Ben Bishop telling me, it's great to have a channel where my family and friends know where to find me.
Mm-hmm.
And then they do this. And so from that aspect, it's a huge embarrassment. From that aspect, it's this whole tournament, boys, we talked about it before, was set up so the USA and Canada could finish with a three-game series for the championship.
Right.
The whole thing was set up that way. You play once in the prelims so TV's happy, and then you come back and play for the championship. And the United States might not win a game in the tournament, depending if they come out against the Czechs like they did against the Finns in the bronze medal game in Sochi. It's a titanic embarrassment. I think it'll resonate with the casual fan, but it's not paramount because we've got football and baseball and the most cuckoo election in the history of American politics going on.
You know, one of the things that fascinates me about this is, you know, the approach taken by the Americans, you know, the sacrificing talent for grit. It seems to me that is just a total misread of what Canadian hockey is all about. You know, like, this team is designed apparently to beat Team Canada. That's a misread. I don't think you beat Team Canada with grit and determination and hard work and all that. I think you beat a skilled team by putting your most skilled players out there, especially in training camp, basically.
I think you're right to a point, but here's and I wrote about this on Puck Daddy this morning. Here's where things went awry. If you look back at that Vancouver team that won silver, that was a team that averaged 4 goals a game. And they averaged 4 goals a game because you had guys like Kessler and Backes and others who were very viable offensive players along with being gritty sandpaper jammy guys.
Right.
But now the problem is that you have those guys on the team plus guys like Dubinsky, plus guys like Abdelkader. And those guys, Kessler and Backes, those types aren't nearly the offensive players they used to be, but
right.
You still put them on the team out of loyalty.
Right.
So they look back at that Vancouver team that Brian Burke built that had sandpaper and skill, very much like this Canadian team, by the way, as Matthew Shane pointed out, the 3 goals they scored were all dirty goals last night. But now those guys have aged out of those roles. And they've overcompensated because they think that's the way to win because they had success in Vancouver. So you're right. Essentially, it's a philosophical problem. And the problem is they look back at that Vancouver thing through clouded eyes, not realizing how much skill they actually had in the team, not realizing that the gritty guys were also skilled guys, and not realizing, of course, at the end of the day, team ain't playing for a gold medal if it ain't for Ryan Miller, you know, doing and lifting during that tournament.
Right.
If you could roll back the clock, Greg, and, you know, and kind of so recast this team in a different form, in a more kind of skilled offensive form, understanding that this tournament was going to be a little more crisp and intense than I think people thought it was going to be right off the hop, maybe understanding that, you know, Team Europe isn't going to be a joke. Like, you know, again, kind of looking at what was available in terms of American hockey talent, taking away the young guys, how, you know, could this have been a team? You know, could you put together an American team that would push Canada in this tournament or not?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, first of all, if you're talking about personnel, I think the middle of this lineup was problematic. And you look at a guy like Tyler Johnson, who, to me, excels in a tournament. Because here's the thing. For all the gritty sandpaper stuff, this is an exhibition tournament in September, and you can look around at all these games, and there's not a lot of hitting. There's not a lot of physicality. And a guy like Tyler Johnson, who can be a little water bug out there, to me, would have excelled in this tournament because of that very thing. So he's won. Obviously, leaving Kessel's goals at home is a mistake, as Phil Kessel will be the first to tell you. And then you look at a guy like Kyle Okposo, who to me is very much in the mold of what they think Backes and Kessler are right now, which is a guy who can be physical but also be an offensive force and also play in your top six, which is, frankly, something that Justin Abdelkader can't do, even though they cast him in that role in the tournament. But the biggest thing is not the players that the United States left home. The biggest thing is the coach they bought to Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And let's dial it back on Tortorella for a second. Not only is his approach to this game archaic and ineffective, but the primary reason he was hired by Team USA was because he didn't have a National Hockey League job. Remember that? They wanted a guy who could dedicate himself to building this team, to scouting this team, and all that jive, who wasn't going to be burdened by coaching in the NHL. And then he gets hired by the Blue Jackets. So one of the primary reasons this guy is even in the job goes out the window, which makes you bang your head against the desk, because then why not just hire Laviolette? Or hire John Cooper with
right.
dual citizenship, although I there's a weird thing going on there with USA Hockey and John Cooper, and I can't figure it out. But that guy to me is Babcock. That guy to me is the giant ego, or Ron Wilson for that matter, the giant ego who comes in, who swaggers and makes you feel like you can look Canada eye to eye, versus Tortorella, who comes in and is blustery and fiery, but at the end of the day makes you feel like you're the underdog, makes you feel like you're the blue-collar guy who goes into that Canadian game hoping and praying you get a break to win.
Yeah, and Cooper also coaches like a guy in the in this decade of the 21st century, right?
That he's, that's true.
That which would help.
What could possibly – that's an interesting point, Greg, and I wasn't aware of that. What could possibly be going on between John Cooper and USA Hockey? Does it – I mean, it couldn't have anything to do with the fact he works for Steve Yzerman, who's closely affiliated with Hockey Canada, could it? I mean
– No, again, this is just speculation.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting point.
Very little information. But it's – I mean, he's not the easiest guy to work with. It's
okay.
Like if you turn the keys to the team to John Cooper – then you got yourself a John Cooper team. And for all of Tortorella's failings as a coach, he's not that difficult to work with as far as working with management. So, I mean, that's the only thing I've heard. But as far as why you don't bring him in, I don't know. And then, if it comes also down to management, because essentially they're going to pick guys that they're loyal to. They're going to pick guys that they're comfortable with. And Cooper's not been in this cycle. I mean, Tortorella was an assistant coach in Vancouver.
Right.
Don't forget that.
Right.
These guys, it's an old boys club, and they like who they like, and that goes through the coaching ranks all the way down to recycling guys like Ryan Kessler and David Backes, probably a little bit after their expiration date.
Looking ahead with this tournament now, Greg, now that we're past the American debacle here, but it sure looks like Canada-Sweden right now. And that could change this afternoon if the Team North America rises up and beats them. Maybe we'll have a different conversation. But right now, it's kind of that seems to be the way it's headed. And again, I have a hard time seeing anybody beating this Canadian team. But do you think, are there any kind of surprises in order in the very few days, actually, that we have left with this tournament?
Oh yeah. I'm obviously hoping that Team North America does pull off some magic today and somehow finds a path to the semifinals. Because I think, from an excitement perspective and from an American television perspective, that might be our only hope for this to resonate back home. But that Team Europe, man, they beat the U.S. and then we all snickered at it. But that's actually a pretty good team. And one of the most fascinating storylines of this tournament is the idea that, were it not for Team Europe, all of these guys wouldn't be playing in the World Cup. I mean, it's been, obviously well-established, well-reported. Kopitar, Zuccarello, Vanek, none of these guys are here if it's not for Team Europe. But now you've kind of turned the dial a little bit to it being a story about how none of these guys ever win at international tournaments.
Mm-hmm.
And now, as Team Europe, they've got a shot. And, Canada's got motivation. Sweden's got motivation. We all wondered what the hell the motivation for Team Europe would be, but they've got it. And they've really come together, played well, and are playing a style of hockey that I think is going to end up frustrating Canada or frustrating Sweden. And they've got a legitimate shot at making the final, which would be a hell of an upset based on what the odds were for that team coming into the tournament.
Well, and especially we know that Team Europe may not exist the next time. And that would be something if your defending champions aren't invited back the World Cup of Hockey.
I think you know, whatever they do with the World Cup next time, I think we're pretty sure there's going to be a U23 team,
right?
Just based on the jersey sales alone. But you're right. I mean, who the heck knows about Team Europe going forward? And you know, the other thing too, the other elephant in the room is the Olympics. It's been the Olympics throughout this tournament, and that's also the big question for the U.S. I mean, it's like, you know, we could see this whole thing change in 2018. Because there won't be a U23 team in South Korea, and Matthews and Eichel and all those guys could be passed the torch, but that remains to be seen if there'll even be the opportunity if the NHL doesn't go.
You know what? It surprised me when you think about Team Europe a little bit. The one thing I've noticed about Team Europe is they also seem to be having a great deal of fun. I mean, if you watch them during the game, there's an awful lot of interaction there. I'm wondering if maybe Ralph Kruger isn't sort of coming back into focus as a potential NHL coach as a result of this. I mean, I know he's got a lot going on. He's going to the World Economic Forum. He's probably got weightier issues on his mind. But it was interesting because I read a piece by Terry Jones in the Edmonton Sun, kind of revisiting Ralph Kruger's stint with the Oilers and just kind of reminding people that, you know what, he wasn't the most hated guy when he was the head coach there. You know, there were a lot of people liked him, and a lot of people in the dressing room liked him.
Yeah, not in the least. He. You could ask those guys that were on that Edmonton team, the younger players, and one of their biggest regrets was not playing well enough to keep him there. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that they don't like McClellan and whoever's there now, but they lament the fact that they only got one season with Kruger because he's a hell of a coach and a really good guy and a guy that you could tell they felt they could grow under. But they didn't play well enough, and the pressures of the market being what they are, he had to go. I don't know if returning to the National Hockey League's even on his plate with everything else he's got going on. But I mean, your original point's correct. Like he's helped bring this team together in record time. Guys from all over the world, different languages, guys who never played together before. He's helped them gel, not only through his personality, but also recognizing the style of hockey they should be playing. They were doing run and gun for the first couple of games. That was a disaster. And then he changed the style and they all felt more comfortable in it. But, you know, I talked to Matt Zuccarello about that during the exhibition games. And he said, the thing about this team is that you play against these guys and you hate them. And then you come into this room and you realize they're all the best guys you've ever met. And I think there's something to be said for the fact that Marian Hossa, Kopitar, Chara, like there's a veteran leadership in that team are all really good guys. And it's going to be really easy for a Leon Draisaitl, for example, to walk into that room, be intimidated by the idols that he sees, but then feel really comfortable really quickly because they're all real decent dudes and they're all there for the right reason. And you know, that's another lesson Team USA could take. I think you got some guys in that room that aren't exactly the same, you know, kind of character as the Europe guys are. And I think the results are clear on the ice.
Now, Greg, you mentioned, you know, the Olympics being kind of the subtext of this, part of the subtext with this tournament. There's no question about that. And, you know, at the very least, the NHL is trying to create some negotiating leverage for themselves with the IOC to try and cut a better deal. Or maybe they're quite ready to walk away, and the owners, I'm certain, are pretty happy to walk away from a tournament in Korea in the middle of the season. But what do you think is going to happen there? And if it's not an NHL tournament, what is it? You know, I can't imagine NHL teams releasing players or releasing young players or releasing guys who just want to go and play for their country to play in a tournament that's not an NHL tournament. What's that going to turn into if it's not the NHL?
Your last point's an interesting one because I've always said that if they don't go, you're going to have European players that are going to find a way to go somehow. Either they leave their teams or they sign someplace else for a season or something. And Ovechkin kind of sounded that alarm again here at the World Cup, and I don't think he's bluffing. It means exponentially more to Russians and others to win gold than it does to win the Stanley Cup in some cases. What is it going to look like? I don't know. And I think the thing when you look at the World Cup and the Olympics and what they're asking for. They're asking for a couple basic things. They're asking for the IOC to cover all of the insurance costs for the players. They're asking for the IOC to spend more money to accommodate the players' families. And the big thing, and as you look around every single retail store in Toronto in over the last couple of weeks, they want to be able to sell gear. They want to be able to sell Olympic-branded merchandise with NHL players' names on it. And you can see why, because they are making a mint here with World Cup of Hockey stuff. Are they going to get all that? I don't know, because the IOC had a leadership change within the last couple of years, and the NHL feels like they're back at square one. You combine that with not really giving a care about the South Korean market, and it doesn't look good. It really doesn't look good. And you know, it'll come down to whether there's a power play. They want to go to China. They want to go to Beijing. They don't want to go to South Korea. If the IOC says you can have both, or you can have none of them, then it's going to really put some pressure on the NHL, because they really do want to go to Beijing. I know that for a fact.
Mr. Wyshynski, great of you to do this as always.
Thanks, boys. I'm going to go jump in a volcano now.
Take care.
Thanks, Greg.
That's Greg Wyshynski, editor of the Puck Daddy blog on Yahoo Sports. I'm going to miss John Tortorella. Not really.
Well, you see him in Columbus until they fire him.
Until they fire him, yeah. Be nice to be around that discussion with Brandon Dubinsky. Sportsnet 590 The Fan, by the way, is proud to sponsor Scotiabank Road Hockey to Conquer Cancer for a sixth consecutive year. This all-day road hockey marathon aims to be the biggest road hockey fundraiser of all time, with all proceeds benefiting the Princess Margaret Cancer Foundation. You can tune in all day tomorrow for Scotiabank Road Hockey to Conquer Cancer Day on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Last year, thanks to your generosity, we raised over $7,000. So tune in for great interviews with special guests. Plus, we'll be auctioning off some incredible gift packages tomorrow. The item you can bid on during our show tomorrow is a foursome of golf at Royal Woodbine Golf Club, plus an autographed Mike Weir frame from the 2004 Players' Championship. You can visit sportsnet.ca/590 for more details. Kind of a bizarre story yesterday. You know, of course, if you've been following Derrick Rose in his career, that he has been involved in a complicated charge of rape. Complicated in that there appears to have been a legal move to remove the anonymity, the right of anonymity from the accuser. And it's a case that, you know, has got many layers to it. It's a case that has absolutely enraged a lot of elements of frankly, of the media, a lot of women's rights groups. It's, you know, it appears to, I mean, it's got everything.
No, a civil suit, not a criminal case.
Civil suit. Yeah, worth
clarifying that.
Yes, yeah. It was a civil suit. Pardon me, a civil suit. But there are many layers to the suit. Yesterday, the NBA Players Association, on their website, essentially they did a puff piece on Derrick Rose. And it was sort of Derrick Rose, his offseason, coming to grips with the move, yada, yada, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Not once was this mentioned in the article. Now, from a journalistic point of view, that would certainly raise some red flags. But I think it kind of gets to something maybe a little deeper than that. You know, we've heard a lot in the past couple of years about the Players Tribune and how, you know, the Players Tribune is giving fans an unfiltered view of professional athletes, an unfiltered view of their lives. And in some cases that it has worked. In some cases, there have been stuff on Players Tribune that's been very interesting. But I mean, in other cases, there's been just a horrible lack of context. This kind of surprises me, because the NBA Players Association, in this particular case, is in fact led by a woman. Lindsay Gibbs is a sports reporter with Think Progress. She's written extensively about this case, and Lindsay Gibbs will join us when the Jeff Blair Show with Stephen Brent continues on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590, The Fan on demand. Now more of the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Welcome back to the Jeff Blair Show. Buck Martinez will join Kevin Barker and myself, by the way, in Baseball Central at noon. Barker's got some thoughts on the importance of pitcher's wins, Mr. Brunt.
Yeah, I know. I can't wait. I mean, it's my, as I get in the car, I will tune in to 590 AM and listen to the words of wisdom coming out of Kevin Barker.
What did
Barker.
He say? I bet you guys are down in RBIs, too.
He did say that. He said a number of things, but that was one of the things he said. So those of you hoping to hear an more old school approach to J-Hop's 20th victory, you're going to get it.
And by the way, the Cracker Barrel poll we were doing yesterday is almost 60% like Cracker Barrel.
That's not
40%
dislike. I think it's horrible, right? Yes.
And one person on Twitter asked Barker's wife if he proposed to her at a Cracker Barrel.
Yeah, and he's offended by the question, but I still don't know the answer.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Anyhow, Baseball Central.
She's a lucky woman.
Truly,
that's what I would say.
Kevin Barker.
She's a lucky woman.
That's what Kevin says all the time.
Yes, she is.
There's a couple of issues at work in our next topic. Derrick Rose has been the subject of a civil lawsuit, a $21.5 million lawsuit filed against him. By a 30-year-old woman who is accusing him and two of his friends of gang raping her after a night of partying in 2013, alcohol-fueled partying in 2013. It's because it's a high-profile professional athlete, in this case, Derrick Rose, who's now with the New York Knicks. It's a case that has attracted a great deal of media attention. I mean, there's so many layers to it. It's attracted a great deal of attention from victims' rights groups, and what happens in a lot of these cases is once they get to a level of complexity, a lot of people kind of tune them out, which isn't right. But I think in a lot of ways, it's understandable in terms of a lot of sports fans. But what happened yesterday was really, well, to me, it kind of put a new twist on this. The NBA Players Association had a feature on Derrick Rose, a lengthy feature on Derrick Rose on its website. And they can certainly do whatever they want. It's their website. But it was a lengthy feature on Derrick Rose. The new Knicks star opens up on change life off the court and empowering children. And, you know, puff pieces on websites are, you know, certainly, Stephen, it's certainly not the first puff piece we've seen in a website. But I think given what's going on around Derrick Rose right now, it seems in the very least to be really tone deaf.
Yeah, no, it's, well, because it talks about character, kind of off court stuff as well,
yes.
Right? And it's very, now, you know, how you would handle that in the context of that piece, given that this is, you know, it's an ongoing civil suit.
True.
These are allegations at this point. You know how, but you have to reference it, I think, somehow.
The
right?
Big difference is if this was a newspaper or any unaffiliated website doing something on this, there would be a line or a paragraph in it.
Yep.
Very least a line or a paragraph saying Rose is embroiled or Rose is involved in a $21.5 million civil lawsuit. And
it also might make you a little queasy about writing a piece about what a great guy he is.
Yeah. Right. But I mean, there would be more, I guess there would be more balance is the way I'm trying to put it. Now, again, this is the NBA Players Association website. They can do whatever they want. But we've seen a move, and it started with the Players Tribune. We've seen a move more and more, I think, towards end runs around what I'm going to call mainstream media outlets, although I don't know if there's such a thing exists anymore as mainstream media outlets. But we've seen, I think, instances of players, executives certainly going directly to the Players Tribune, and you know the idea is, hey, you're getting an unfiltered look at what I'm about. You're getting unfiltered opinions from me, as opposed to some guy or some woman who's a sports writer, kind of trying to tell you what I said and sort of trying to filter what I told them in order to get it through to you. And it, you know, it serves a purpose, but I also think in a lot of ways it's dangerous because sometimes it kind of becomes put in the same level as journalism, and it's not.
Well,
it's not in the same level of journalism.
I don't know what the level of journalism. You know, like there's, that's an interesting. You know, that's a long discussion.
But it's a personal opinion.
Like nothing's. Look, there's no such thing as objectivity. Everything is subjective. And all stories, no matter who they're written by, and no matter where they appear, involve choosing what's in and what's not in.
Right.
So we.
But I guess because of this website, and I'm going to bring in our next guest, Lindsay Gibbs, is a sports reporter for Think Progress. And she joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. Lindsay, thanks so much for your patience while we kind of wrestle with this. But one of the things I did want to say is my concern is that I think a lot of people read websites like the Players Tribune and assume there's going to be objectivity. And there isn't. I mean, essentially, as we've seen with the NBA Players Association site, you're getting puff pieces. But I want to ask you, first of all, just about the impact, like just the idea that the NBA Players Association would run this story in their website at a time when this is going on. You know, my response would be, if you're not going to at least address the issue, then don't write the Derrick Rose story.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, it's not like, you know, it's not like this is a Kobe Bryant's retiring and you have to write something about him, right? You know, and you don't know whether or not to include the fact that he was in a rape case, you know, 12 years ago. I mean, this is a guy whose trial starts in 2 weeks. You have tons of other players you can profile, and it seems very transparent to do a piece like this now. Of course, I'm sure Rose wouldn't agree to a piece like this if they were going to ask him questions. You know, I mean, it's just very transparent, and I think very unfortunate that the NBA Players Association would choose to publish a piece like that at this time.
Do you think there's any connection between that, Lindsay, and the fact that Rose's accuser did a bunch of interviews in the last little while that she talked, under, you know, as Jane Doe? And that her story was out there in a lot of places.
I mean, there certainly might be, although this seemed like a piece that has kind of been in the works, you know, for longer than a few days. But of course, there certainly could be. Of course, you know, there's a significant difference as those interviews were, you know, related to the trial itself, whereas this was related totally to his character off court. I mean, you know, this wasn't we're analyzing how he's going to help the Knicks, you know, which would be somewhat of a more legitimate way to tackle, you know, Derrick Rose right now. You know, how can he help the Knicks on court? This was a let's look at his impact off the court, you know. And I think it's scary to have something like that written, you know, when he's in the middle of about to go on trial for gang rape. You know, how do you not mention that?
You know what? The other thing that bothers me about this, too, and, you know, this may sort of not be politically correct, and I'm probably going to be accused of a little bit of sexism here, and I don't mean it, but, you know, the NBA Players Association's executive director is a woman, and I understand that she, you know, she works for her, you know, her clients. She works for the Players Association. But I got to think Michelle Roberts, on some level, this can't sit well with her, can it?
I don't think so. I mean, of course, I'm speculating as well. But, yeah, I was disappointed because I would hope she would be a little bit more sensitive to these issues. And like I said, there was no reason you had to have a big piece on Derrick Rose, you know, this week. There was no reason that 3,000 words had to be published on your site about Derrick Rose this week. You know, it was not a requirement from the Players Association. So, but if you are going to write 3,000 words on Derrick Rose this week, I think you have to mention that he is, you know, that you know, a woman has accused of a gang rape, and that the allegations at least have enough credibility that they've moved forward to the civil trial, you know, that they weren't dismissed in summary judgment.
How does, Lindsay, rolling back, how did this wind up being a civil, handled in the civil courts and not in the criminal courts? Was there any attempt to bring a criminal case against Derrick Rose?
Yes, a police report has been filed. She didn't come forward till a while, you know, after the incident occurred, when she decided to kind of proceed. But the reason the civil case is happening now is because of the statute of limitations in Los Angeles. It's 6 years for criminal, but only 2 years for civil.
Okay.
So if it was going to go forward at all, and of course, you know, from everything we know, that there's still an ongoing investigation, it seems her lawyers seem to believe that they're kind of waiting for the civil trial to progress before they decide whether or not to do criminal charges, because of course it's a much higher threshold for guilt.
I was going to say the burden of proof is different, right?
It's much, much, much more difficult. But the main reason is the statute of limitations. It's only 2 years for a civil case.
Now, I have to admit, I just assumed that in a case like this, that the plaintiff had the right to anonymity. And I admit, I just assumed that. And now we find out that a U.S. district judge hearing Jane Doe's case has ruled that once the trial begins, she can no longer hide behind her pseudonym.
Yeah.
I didn't know a judge could do that. I just didn't.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
It's definitely different. I mean, the thresholds are different per state, and also when you're talking about criminal versus civil again, Rose's legal team has been trying to threaten her by getting her name revealed and out there since this began a year ago. And she's talked, in the interviews last week, she talked about how important anonymity was to her. So this was obviously a big point of contention. The judge had previously ruled that she could remain anonymous during pretrial proceedings, that she could keep the Jane Doe pseudonym during pretrial proceedings. But that was for the trial itself, just ruled yesterday. And we do not have the official judge's decision yet, so we don't officially know the background of that full decision. But from what the lawyers have said, it seems like the judge was worried about seeming biased if he allowed her to continue with her name, which is confusing.
Right.
And he was just very concerned about seeming fair to both parties. And there's this concept that everyone knows, who Derek Rose is, so everyone should know who she is as well.
And again, am I wrong that there seems to be at least an assumption that the judge is connecting that decision to the fact that she did a bunch of interviews in the last little while?
Well, it's interesting because he also said beforehand that she was that was a possibility. Like, because when he made the ruling back in June on the anonymity for pretrial, I mean, she didn't violate a gag order. There was no gag order on this case for talking to media. Of course, we don't know how much that did weigh in, but it seemed more than anything the judge was just concerned about fairness and not seeing bias, against Rose headed into the trial.
And again, I don't know anything about American Rape Shield laws, but I would assume that it's as they exist, they would only apply to the criminal courts, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
They exist.
Lindsay, we appreciate you joining us. Thanks so much.
Thank you guys for having me.
It's Lindsay Gibbs, sports reporter with Think Progress. And as we said, it's an interesting case with a lot of levels.
Oh, yeah. It's a very murky and potentially ugly case that's going to proceed. A lot of people, again, the shock seems to be that it hasn't been settled at this stage, that it has not been made to go away one way or another.
Well, I think the end game here from, a lot of people would just assume that by having or preventing this woman from being able to retain anonymity, one of the end games for Rose's lawyers will be there's going to be settlement at some point, but this might cut into that settlement. In other words, if the plaintiff is scared because she doesn't want her name in public, then A, it may not go to trial. Although you'd have to think that at this stage, from her point of view, she's probably going to take it to trial, wouldn't you?
I don't know.
And secondly, though, even if it does go to trial, then perhaps there's a greater chance of reaching some sort of settlement here at a lesser amount of money, because the threat is there of her being named publicly.
And again, we've had a lot of conversation in this country about some very high profile sexual assault cases recently, but this is not. The difference here is this is not a criminal case.
Exactly. Right.
So and as Lindsay said, to get to this point, you have to go through the process to the degree that there's enough merit to take this forward, that judgment has been made, that there was enough merit to bring this through. And the burden of proof is not proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's a lower bar, right? So there's all kinds of other factors in this, and the rules that would apply in a criminal case don't necessarily apply, including rape shield laws. So it's up to the the judge can make the decision that that the plaintiff's name can can go public. It is, but you know, to get back to where you were originally with this thing, Jeff, it's an odd decision to run that particular Derrick Rose piece, which is about what a great guy he is, A, at this time, and B, without at least three lines in brackets saying, by the way, you know, he does stand accused in a civil case of sexual assault. It's an odd journalistic decision, whatever, you know. And again, I think the definition of, you know, the notion of kind of traditional journalism versus non-traditional journalism, or, you know, or content providing or whatever, it's all very gray these days, you know. So the best advice to anybody is, you know, whenever you read anything, exercise your own judgment, you know. Don't let other people be the gatekeepers. You be the gatekeeper. Understand that it's, you know, everything comes with a point of view, you know, and everything comes with bias.
And just because something is going to be sold to you as being unfiltered, it's being filtered.
Well,
everything's filtered.
Look, you know, you and I work for a very respected news organization for a long time. Decisions are made.
Yep.
It doesn't matter. New York Times makes decisions about what gets in and what doesn't get in. By definition, that makes things subjective, not objective.
That's right. And if you want to extend it even further, where a story is played, how much space it's given.
Yeah. All of those.
All of that acts as a filter.
Mm-hmm.
And you're essentially saying, you know, if a story's in the front page of a newspaper, you're saying this is very important.
Yes.
And that's a filter. That's somebody exercising some degree of prejudice. But I just think this is important because I know that, I mean, there's so many websites out there and everything. And, you know, I just think people need to, just because you read it on Players Tribune, for example, doesn't mean it's sacrosanct.
No, look, I've read some really interesting stuff on Players
Tribune.
There's
been some tremendous
stuff I wouldn't have seen anywhere else.
Yeah, but there's been some bull slung out there, too.
Oh, yeah, but there's bull slung everywhere, right? I take it for what it is. And, you know, and if you think, you know, if there's value in it, you think you're getting something, a point of view you wouldn't get somewhere else. Yeah. It's, again, I read it for that. And I say I've read pieces on there that I don't think I would have ever read in a more conventional newspaper or website.
Yeah.
Because the players do feel like they control it, you know, but they do control it.
Mr. Brunt, thank you for doing this. We'll see you manana.
See you tomorrow. Can't wait for Barker.
Oh, Barker's fired up. Look at that. He's
caffeinating right now.
He's caffeinating. Yeah, you're number one, too, Barker. You're number one, too. Baseball Central with Kevin Barker and Buck Martinez is next.